I had received the status of an honored guest a few days earlier after completing a chain of socialization quests in the Dwarven City. Cool. It really did impact my relationship. I asked if Pyrona Zealous had the rare alchemy ingredient Ifrit Heart.
No, sir. I've never had such a thing. But I do have lots of other items in stock. Elixirs and magic bombs, and a full array of body fragments of subterranean creatures from all of Dotur Kawe. Tusks, hearts, brains, blood, poisonous glands, everything an alchemist might need.
Of course, my interest was piqued by one part in particular. Full array, subterranean creatures, blood. But I screwed up my green mug into a bored expression. With these traders, if you let them know an item has your interest, the price will instantly take off into the heavens. So I approached from afar, first looking over some subterranean mushrooms in a glass case, and even buying the cheapest ones for my alchemy pursuits. After that, I filled out my empty bottle reserves, picked up a few crucibles and flask holders, magic ice for storing tissue samples, and a porcelain mortar for powdering plants. And I actually bought two magical bombs, Frost Breath and Flame Rage. And only after that, as if by coincidence, did I agree to look over her collection. In the end, my preparations came to naught. No matter how I tried to veil my interest in blood samples, even purposely adding things I didn't need to water down the purchase, like teeth, glands, and claws, Pyrona Zealous guessed nevertheless. We were negotiating for every new vial at screeching tones, raising my trading skill to 20, 21, and then 22. I acquired 43 new blood samples for my vampiric collection, and left only two unbought, the rarest ones. Horror of the Depths blood, alchemy ingredient. Balrog blood, alchemy ingredient. The trader wanted 15,000 coins for each of the vials. I considered her price excessive, because that was about as much as all my previous purchases cost put together. The trader explained that, first off, the Balrog was an extremely rare creature, which was to say nothing of the fact that killing such a powerful and dangerous fire beast was a serious undertaking. This particular monster had been found around 3 years earlier in the depths of the catacombs under the capital of the dwarves, and a large army of hundreds of undying had gathered to kill it. The trophy drop at that time was rich, and some of the loot was unloaded by the undying right here in Dotur Kawe. Its fire-resistant pelt, tusks stronger than diamond, bones, blood, and horns. But over the 3 years since then, all that had been bought and used by alchemists and craftsmen, and this vial of blood was all that remained. And now, the trader couldn't say when there might be more, or even if there ever would be. I opened the Boundless Realm bestiary and searched for information about the Balrog. Yes, everything was just as Pyrona Zealous said. It was an extremely rare and dangerous monster that inhabited the very depths of the subterranean. My eye caught on the part saying the first Balrog kill was by a human wizard named Gandalf the Grey, and that he had done it solo. But there were no links to his profile, which led me to think he must have been permanently banned from Boundless Realm for cheating. The situation with the Horror of the Depths was approximately the same. The extremely rare and deadly dangerous monster was also invisible, so any trophies received from it were extremely rare. Everything added up. Trophies from such monsters should cost a lot. But at that, I understood perfectly that, in order to fully reveal the potential of my goblin vampire, these blood samples would be needed one day, and there was no guarantee I would ever find such a thing again if I didn't get these two rare vials now. But still, I was not morally prepared to pay 15,000 coins for each one. But Pyrona Zealous balked, not wanting to lower the price no matter how I tried to convince her. Even the first specialization I took in the trading skill, Honest Reputation, which was supposed to increase relationship with any NPC traders, didn't help one bit. To be more accurate, the prices for all the rest of the goods in the alchemy shop were lowered, but as for those two vials, she wouldn't budge. It seemed I was coming up against a programmed-in rule against lowering the price. Once upon a time, I had come up against the same in the village of Tish, when Niall Miser had not agreed to lower the price on the thief clothes for Taisha, but then the trader's stubbornness was part of a quest. What if this was a similar obstacle? Sensing that I was on the right track, I began to carefully sound it out, touching on various topics and carefully observing the lady's reaction. Offer to trade the vials I needed for equally valuable elixirs? Clearly not it. The promise to buy goods for an insignificant value, like armor and weapons, from Pyrona Zelis's relatives? Also didn't help. Although, as for relatives, the lady still did express some interest. Something connected with relatives. So thus, by probing blindly, I eventually figured it out.
Amra, my children are grown up. I have 6 wonderful sons. But if only you knew how hard it is for young dwarven men to find a bride. After all, in our submontane folk, only 1 girl is born for every 5 boys, and competition for the heart of every subterranean beauty is just bonkers. Nevertheless, I managed to set up my eldest 3 sons. Another 2 are now vying for the heart of their chosen woman, currying favor and earning respect with their mastery. And just my youngest, little Tondik, still cannot find success in love. He's modest and easily embarrassed, and every girl he ever liked was capricious and finicky. They only want the richest, bravest, strongest, and most vaunted. But where is a peaceable cook to earn his glory and fame? So then I thought, Amra, take him with you on your adventure. As a reward, take any of the 2 monster blood vials you were offered. You'll get the 2nd after my little Tondik comes home from the adventure intact and unharmed.
An unexpected turn of events. The shrewd trader had surprised me with an unusual suggestion. Before that, I had already told Pyrona Zelis about my plan to travel up the River of Death, but I was not expecting our conversation to take this turn. And also, I immediately noticed the flaws in Pyrona's suggestion.
And what if your little son doesn't want to come back home? For example, if he takes to life on the road, or meets the love of his life and decides to stay with her. Amra, knowing my homebody's son, I'd never believe that my little Tondik would enjoy the restless life of a nomad. But if he does find love in far-off lands, what mother would talk her son out of marriage? Right on the day my beloved son is married, I'll give you the 2nd vial. But now, I'll fill your bag with healing elixirs and all kinds of plants to aid you on your journey. And I'll tell every alchemist I know about your kindness and concern for me. Well, goblin, what do you say? Shake on it?
I thought over the suggestion of the corpulent trader. I saw very serious downsides to the suggestion to drag a mama's boy who was totally unprepared for such a journey along with me. And also, constantly protecting someone else's son from danger and bringing him home in one piece sounded difficult. On the other hand, the reward I was promised was more than generous. I agreed, squeezing the bearded lady's calloused hand. Trading skill increased to level 23. Foreman skill increased to level 31. Mission completed. Recognition of the alchemist's guild. 2 of 10. Experience received. 160 experience. Alchemy skill increased to level 24. Mission received. Marrying off a son. Mission class. Rare. Personal. Description. Lead Tondik Exuberant to the upper reaches of the Styx and bring him back to Dotur Kawe. Required. Tondik Exuberant must survive. Reward. 40,000 experience. Vial of Horror of the Depths blood. Bonus condition. Make Tondik Exuberant a famous dwarven traveler and find him a wife. Reward, 80,000 experience, plus 10 to the opinion of all dwarves in Boundless Realm.
Pyrona Zelis, clearly having planned this out, squeezed my hand strongly in her iron grip. I don't know what the lady was expecting. Perhaps she just wanted to laugh at a little bat-eared goblin, or to demonstrate her power, but I had to put the traitor in her place.
Ow, that hurt! Let go, I was just joking!
The corpulent woman pulled her hand away and spent a long time blowing on her reddened palm. I then took the Balrog blood vial from the shelf and placed it in my bag. After that, I said severely,
"As for getting equipment for your son, that's up to you. Just consider this, woman. The lands around the River of Death are dangerous and unwelcoming. If you want your beloved son to live, don't cheap out on good armor and weaponry. I'll come back to your shop at precisely 8 p.m. If Tondik isn't ready, I'll leave without him. And also, you probably have some good armorers around, right?"
The corpulent trader gave a very fast nod that looked funny on her body, as if a ball filled with water slightly shuddered, or a wave ran over the surface of a pond.
"Well, I have no time to look for good craftsmen in your huge and confusing city. If you have any acquaintances that want to sell their goods, they can find me at 8 p.m. in your shop. Tell them that I want a helmet, boots, leather armor, a cloak, and a blowgun with a set of ammo. All of the best quality, with bonuses to agility, perception, and intelligence. As for skill improvements on the items, it'd be nice to have stealth, dodge, acrobatics, and exotic weapon. The success of the whole journey depends largely on whether the commander of the squadron can survive, so I hope greatly that you understand that overcharging for my equipment would not be the wisest decision, if you want to see your youngest son return alive and well. I'll pay a fair price for expensive and quality items, but I will not allow anyone to shamelessly squeeze money out of me."
Trading skill increased to level 24.
After making sure the trader understood the gravity of the moment, would find truly good craftsmen for me and not allow any of her acquaintances to fleece me, I bid farewell until evening and left the alchemy shop. The clock before my eyes was showing almost 9 o'clock in the morning. I hadn't noticed that so much time had passed in Pyrona Zealous's shop. I wanted horribly to sleep. I couldn't keep my eyes open. But before leaving Boundless Realm, I looked for a quiet corner in the city of the dwarves, where none of the locals would notice me, and I started to uncork the vials of blood, tasting the vampire-tempting treats one after the other.
Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 44 of 1,000. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 45 of 1,000. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 50 of 1,000. Attention. Resistance to sunlight increased. Sunlight will now cause damage at a rate of 800 hit points per second. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 60 of 1,000. Regeneration improved to 7 hit points per minute. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 70 of 1,000. Regeneration improved to 10 hit points per minute. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 80 of 1,000. Regeneration improved to 15 hit points per minute. Achievement unlocked. Taste tester. 87 of 1,000.
I'd never before drank blood in such quantity, so the extreme intoxication that followed came as a surprise. My big-eared goblin herbalist was not able to stand firmly, which was to say nothing about performing complicated actions. It was absolutely impossible to play such an unresponsive character. Fortunately, I was already about to leave. After making sure Amra had no penalties against exiting Boundless Realm, and 30 seconds later the character would just disappear, I called up the game menu and chose Exit Game. New Hardships. It was loud and crowded on the tester floor today. A wave of newbies had arrived, completely green. Some of them hadn't even set up their virtual reality capsules or generated their characters yet. Taking advantage of the fact that no one knew their work neighbor, I also pretended to be new, thus avoiding unnecessary attention. First off, I was too tired to talk with the ones who were having a gab fest in the hallway instead of quickly entering the game. Second, I understood perfectly that the trial period for this whole huge crowd would be passed by very few, and I simply didn't want to waste my time. And third, I had absolutely no desire to tell them about myself or my character. I really had quite a bit to hide, and understood Kira with her paranoid reserve more and more. After taking a shower and getting a quick snack and mineral water in the break area, I returned to my gaming room. My phone, which I'd left there to charge, had one missed call. The number was stored in my contacts under the name Voldemar KSM, but it took me some time to remember who that was. Ah, it was my former neighbor from the criminal neighborhood. A long time ago, a year and a half or maybe two, he and I had played Kingdoms of Sword and Magic together and talked fairly in depth. But then Voldemar found stable work and left the game, then moved to a better neighborhood, and our friendship had come to an end. I'll be direct. It was an unexpected call from the past. We'd never been true friends, just acquaintances. What could he want from me? Now I was deciding whether to call him back or not. Another call came in from Voldemar. I accepted.
"Hello, Timothy. If you don't recognize the number, it's your old neighbor from the old hood. I'm calling to warn you. I had to drop by my old place this morning to ask a friend some questions. Anyway, I was stopped in the stairway by dangerous thugs from the Grave Worms gang. They interrogated me about you. Of course, I just said that I don't know shit and haven't seen you for 3 years, but from the conversation, I realized that someone was willing to pay very handsomely to have you killed, and that they're looking for you actively. Timothy, the gangsters don't know where you live, but for some reason, they're sure you work as a tester for the Boundless Realm Corporation. They discussed ways of getting you at work right in front of me. Like, one of them was going to call about the job advertisement and interview, then find you in the corporation building and take you out. And they even offered to let me join in. They promised me 2,000 credits. I whistled in surprise. For the criminal outskirts of the metropolis, 2,000 credits was an unimaginable amount of money. Of course, I was no expert in the matter, but it seemed to me a typical murder cost a lot less.
That's what I'm saying, Voldemar agreed. I mean, out there, every other person is ready to cut someone down for 100 coins, and if we're talking about a few thousand, then the line of takers would stretch to the horizon. I can't say for sure what you did to make them so mad, but you should know they're after you.
All right, then, I warned you. Be careful, Timothy. I thanked my old acquaintance for the warning, said goodbye, and started thinking hard. I understood how the gangsters knew where I worked. It was probably from Jane, my old boss. But, to be honest, I was expecting the unpleasant story with the racketeers from the Grave Worms to be left in the past, after the gang got taken out by a special brigade of Boundless Realm Corporation soldiers. I didn't know how that special operation had ended, and didn't want to know for the sake of my own nerves. But I was counting on never again hearing about Jane, who turned out to be a surprisingly unprincipled slimeball, nor her dangerous cohorts. My phone rang again, and I looked at the name of the caller on screen, shuddered in fear and nearly threw the phone across the room. It was Jane herself. After a moment of hesitation, I accepted the call.
Good morning, Timothy. Max Toner is expecting you in his office on floor 44.
The voice of the girl on the line was young and pleasant, but totally unfamiliar. It took me a few seconds to realize I wasn't hearing Jane's voice, but that of the new director's assistant, calling from her work number. Wow, that put my heart at ease. What could I say? I was supposed to talk with my boss last night, so I went straight to the elevator shaft and pressed 44.
Take a seat, Timothy, the special projects director pointed to the guest chair. I know you're tired after your game session, but don't worry, I won't be keeping you long. I actually have an important meeting with marketing people about the next big update in 10 minutes, so I'll be brief. I want to know about your companion, Taisha. Tell me about her.
Yet again. Every one of my bosses had brought up the advanced NPC thief, and for some reason thought that I was the one who should know the answers to all their questions. So I had to explain for the umpteenth time that I had a very weak understanding of what was contained in the next-generation NPC's algorithms. Also, I said Taisha had been made by the very same team of programmers that had earlier worked on intelligence algorithms for the Grey Pack, and they had worked on the basis of an assignment given by my former boss, Alexandro Lavrias. But the thing was that all of them, both my first boss and his programmers, had turned out to be mixed up in a scandal selling intellectual property of the Boundless Realm Corporation, and were fired.
Yes, I was already told that part of the story yesterday at the director's meeting, as well as the fact that no documentation on that project was retained. Max Toner agreed, but his curiosity was already sated. I'd just like to find out more, something that goes beyond the bounds of simple words. After all, you've been communicating with Taisha for quite some time. You must have noticed some strange aspects of her behavior.
Strange? Here I couldn't hold back and laughed uncontrollably. Yeah, everything about Taisha could never be called anything other than strange. Let's start with the fact that Taisha can now approach player respawn stones, which mobs are not supposed to be able to get near. Without any noticeable exertion, she can get right past magic barriers made to hold NPCs at bay. Taisha can make whole regions of Boundless Realm freeze up, requiring insanely huge computing power if she is presented with a complicated or unsolvable mission. Although, that was all fairly long ago. The programmers must have fixed that bug already.
It isn't totally fixed yet, but as far as I know, they're working on it actively, the director told me. Some of the most obvious processes leading to memory outflow were discovered and fixed, but the programmers discovered that Taisha's code is very trickily encrypted, and they cannot get through to her logic core. Attempts to copy every file associated with Taisha and move them to an isolated sandbox in order to figure out her behavior algorithms met with great difficulties. Her program, like a computer virus, artificially hides parts of itself on various cluster servers, doubling important fragments of its body many times, constantly checking the integrity of its files and not launching if it doesn't see Boundless Realm around it. And starting recently, this strange program even learned to communicate with the real world. It can activate external libraries and services that are totally outside the virtual game, so tricking it and locking it in a sandbox is practically impossible. Yes, Taisha was always interested in the world of the undying. She has a passionate desire to become like a player, constantly asking me to tell her about our world. And yesterday she even called me on the cell phone.
That's exactly what I said, just in other words, the director snorted, none too pleased. It was actually because of that call that all this boiled over yesterday. I think, Timothy, that you must understand perfectly that no computer program, even the most advanced and perfect imitation of human behavior, should act like that. A report about that incident reached the president of the corporation, Thomas Haywood, and he took it very seriously. He came back early from vacation and went straight here, immediately calling an emergency meeting. Our experts see just two options. First, we are dealing with a live player or even an organized group that managed to log into the corporation's servers and is skillfully leading us by the nose. Second, we have come up against something fantastical and previously considered impossible. The watch on the director's arm beeped, so Max Toner broke off and didn't finish his sentence. Damn, I'm already late to the meeting. Gotta run. The director stood up from the huge leather seat and spun around in front of the mirror. After that, he demanded in an upset tone that the new long-legged secretary tie his tie and fix his haircut. I'll admit, I had been eyeing this unknown doll-faced girl since I got here. She had a model's looks and purple hair in a complicated haircut. She must have been the one who called me a few minutes ago. On the director's orders, the girl sat calmly in the assistant's chair, looked at the screen of her computer, and pretended she had absolutely no interest in our conversation. And yet, the director's assistant must have been totally inactive for a few minutes, because her monitor screen was now off. Is Taisha an artificial intelligence? I tried to guess the end of my boss's unfinished sentence, but he didn't confirm or deny that theory.
Timothy, I didn't say that, and it's too early to judge. There are certain facts that prove both possible hypotheses. In any case, don't let your companion Taisha get away from you, and observe her carefully. And as for the telephone call... Here, my boss abruptly turned and stared me stubbornly right in the eyes. Yesterday, a tester employee asked our in-game security service about that, and so the direct and extremely unambiguous answer, which the president of the corporation himself ordered sent on to all our departments and official figures, is this: no, such a call did not happen and never could. NPC characters are not capable of making phone calls to the real world, period. And I also demand that you stick to that official version of events until the end of the investigation. Consider that an order.
With those words, Max Toner, taking another look at his watch and spitting another curse, grabbed his tablet from the table and hurried off to a meeting. And although I had a ton of questions for him, and, more importantly, objections about keeping Taisha's phone call a secret, I didn't risk stopping my boss. Now was not the time, and it couldn't bring me anything but more problems. As soon as the doors closed behind him, the purple-haired girl called out, offering to get me a coffee. I was planning to leave the boss's office, but stopped. Coffee was just the thing I needed to perk me up after the sleepless night.
"My name's Tina," the girl introduced herself, even though I didn't ask. "Before this, I worked for the company for 3 years as a traveling employee. I was a model at all kinds of events. I handed out ads and souvenirs at gaming industry exhibitions, stood at Boundless Realm stands and attracted visitors. I went all over the planet in those 3 years. At first, it's interesting, but soon you get sick of it. And now, I wanted to switch to a more relaxed position without all that moving around. And although there were 35 people who applied to be the director's personal assistant, Max Toner chose me. Here's your coffee, Timothy. Do you want anything with it? Crackers? Pastries?
I asked for pastries, and Tina practically ran out of the office to fulfill my request. I'll be honest, I wasn't used to having a peer act so deferential to me. It was even a bit awkward. What was more, I didn't understand why a girl I barely knew would tell me her whole life story, bend over backwards for me, and so obviously attempt to get to know me better. It could hardly be simple politeness. Tina didn't treat her boss like that. Also, it wasn't part of the job requirements for the assistant to the director of special projects to wait hand and foot on the normal testers. In fact, the director's assistant was supposed to be deeply indifferent to average employees, given that her personal career and salary didn't depend on that whatsoever. There was the possibility that Tina just thought I was cute, but I didn't consider it seriously. Such a remarkable beauty probably had a steady man already, and maybe even a whole line of admirers. And even if I was wrong about Tina being taken, such stylish model girls knew their own value and would never be seeking relationships with guys they'd just seen for the first time in their life.
Really?
An internal voice acridly reminded me of Kira, but I immediately found 100 differences between those circumstances. At that moment, apologizing for the delay, Tina returned with a tray of pastries. I noticed that, while the girl was gone, she had time to make up her lashes and put on a different, brighter lipstick. This was looking less and less like simple politeness. Probably, a gallant gentleman would express a sense of tact and diplomacy in such a situation, and give the lady a few compliments, take the opportunity for a pleasant chat, and get to know her better. But after the sleepless night, I just wanted to finish my business quickly, go home and sleep until my next gaming session. So I asked Tina a very direct, probably tactless question, asking why she was trying so hard to make me like her. It came out a bit rude, and I even thought the girl would get offended. Tina froze and looked at me for a few seconds, before she lowered her gaze in shame and answered my question with a question.
Is it really that obvious?
I just smiled in silence, which embarrassed her all the more. Tina even went slightly red, then decided to admit it.
All right, Timothy, it would be dumb to deny it. I heard about you many times and saw promo clips about the goblin herbalist and his flying wyvern. And yes, I really was trying to catch your gaze. No matter what, it isn't every day you meet a millionaire who is also a handsome young man and not married. For me, for example, this is a first in my whole life. So, obviously, feminine instinct kicked in.
What can I say? Thank you for the frankness, Tina. But I'm not a millionaire. Not even close, I tried to convince her. I was not allowed to sell the Royal Forest Wyvern, and my character doesn't have anything else quite that valuable. Yes, I got decent payouts for taking part in the Great Hunt, but that wasn't anywhere near a million, unfortunately. The director's assistant shook her head in disbelief and smiled.
I heard something totally different this morning in this very office. Max Toner was told by the higher-ups that your character has a strong influence on the NPC Taisha, and that it would be absolutely impossible to unravel her computer algorithms without your help. The goblin Amra is the only character in Boundless Realm Taisha truly trusts, so it is principally important that you be satisfied with your work and remain an employee. The boss was told to treat you as delicately as possible, and they said they were afraid that if you were unhappy, you might simply sell your virtual property for real money and quit, and that the money you could get for that would be enough for the rest of your life. I even heard someone say, potentially, he's a multimillionaire and could easily get by without working here.
What could I say? Today, my boss's behavior really was unlike yesterday, and for the better at that. But as for me being a potential multimillionaire, I was totally thrown off and couldn't hide my incomprehension. After all, I had no idea of the total value of my items, but still didn't imagine it came to anywhere near 1 million. Even considering the percent from the corporation for selling the Great Hunt participation tokens, I still had no more than 530,000. Of course, That was definitely not bad for a person who couldn't make rent just 1 month ago. But still, it was not 1 million credits, and certainly not several million. I must have been missing something. In any case, the information Tina gave me was valuable, and I thanked my new acquaintance for telling me. But as for the offer to go out for lunch or dinner the girl made immediately thereafter, I refused. Tina was clearly crestfallen and started suggesting other options of how we could spend time together, but I was firm in my decision and didn't want to get to know the director's new assistant any closer than work required. My new acquaintance just didn't understand that her activity might be strongly upsetting to another employee of this corporation, who had the power to not only fire Tina from her new job, but also to make lots of other problems for a romantic rival. However, these other problems started much earlier, in just 15 minutes, and with me. The electronic key to call an elevator to floor 333 of the castle didn't work, and I couldn't get into my place. What the hell? I tried it a few times on the panel of the high-speed passenger elevator, and also on the panel of the more sluggish freight elevator, but the data reader was stubbornly refusing to accept my card and confirm my ability to access the isolated floor. There was no way except the elevator to get to that floor of the residential skyscraper tower, which Kira owned in its entirety. And only Kira herself decided who got the right to access it and who was not allowed. Could my girlfriend really have gotten offended and cut off my access? An inner voice was telling me yes. Yesterday evening, when we'd parted ways, we had technically been fighting. She clearly didn't believe me about the phone call from Taisha and asked that very question to the in-game security service of Boundless Realm, which had brought it all the way to the leadership of the corporation, including the president. What could I say? From there, it was clear. The corporation had told her no, and now she thought I was a liar and had cut off all contact. It was harsh, but completely in my girlfriend's spirit. Although, despite all the facts on the ground, I couldn't believe Kira had decided to part with me once and for all. Show her disapproval, sure. And it was even possible that she wanted to show me how much I needed her. But Kira was not the kind of person who would keep quiet and be embarrassed about her decision to end a relationship. To my eye, the situation resembled our first meeting in some way. Then Kira felt awkward next to me, avoided me for a few days, and was annoyed, expecting that I would be seeking out meetings with her and bothering her with my company. But when I didn't chase after her, she decided to get near me. I think I now needed to act that very same way, not getting on her nerves and letting her cool off. And although I could send a message to Kira through the head of her security team as before, given I still had his number, or at the very least through her influential grandmother, I preferred not to use these options. What could I do right now? I wanted to sleep horribly. Book a room in a hotel? I had easily enough money to get even the most fashionable apartments in the center of the megalopolis, but doing that without it going up the chain to the police database and various other organs of state control was impossible, and I didn't want any record of where I could be found. Telling the whole world about my location wouldn't be the smartest move, especially if I considered the fact that the grave worms had it out for me. So, what remained? I remembered that I had the experience of napping during the day in my work cabin right in the uncovered virtual reality capsule, and had even gotten decent sleep. There was nothing else to do. I went back to work. On my way, I went into the supermarket and bought something to eat. I was reminded that in my game cabin there was a refrigerator, even though I had never even opened it before. It would seem that the time had come to start using it. Sometime later, I left the supermarket with full bags in my hands and called my sister. My sister told me that she had been in the game since the morning and had already led my orcs to the edge of the great desert. Now, the orcish army was making camp on a high hill overgrown with thorny brush, and they could already see the bank of the large black river on the horizon. If everything proceeded like that, my brutes would reach the banks of the Styx by this evening. Great, Val! As soon as you get there, tell the coordinates of your camp to Max Sochnier, so he can meet us with his galley. So where are you, Tim? I just looked around, and Taisha, the Grey Pack, and Vixen are all gone. I told Valeria that last night I'd managed to reach the subterranean city of Dotur Kawe and pick up the package. The purchase turned out right, and I thanked my brilliant little sister yet again for her wonderful intuition. I also told her that I had to stick around in the dwarven town to make some more purchases, and now the bright light of day would keep me in the caves until evening. But at that, it seemed I had found a good chef for my savages, so the orcs would be fed right instead of just wolfing down loads of filth. I didn't mention the strange situation with Taisha, having decided to tell my sister about all that one-on-one. What was more, I didn't immerse my sister in my problems with Kira, the grave worms, or our lack of home. Valeria couldn't help me in these matters, but it would spoil her mood for a long time. I told Valeria I would be sure to visit her in the hospital this evening before work, bring her a bag of fruit and gifts, and speak with the doctors. But, I said, if we didn't have enough time to chat, we could keep talking in Boundless Realm. Val lit up at my upcoming visit, then changed the topic.
Tim, I've been studying the map of Styx you gave me last night, and I have a couple very interesting ideas I'd like to discuss. But that would be a really long conversation, so let's do it not over the phone. So we can talk in the evening at the clinic or when we meet at night in the game. I'll tell you the coordinates of the orc camp on the bank of the Styx over the phone, and you can fly on Vixen after it gets dark.
I got surprisingly good sleep, despite the semi-Spartan conditions and constant buzz of many voices coming from the hallway. During the day, there were always dozens, if not hundreds, of testers talking outside. I was even getting the impression that many noobs spent the majority of their workday not in their game cabins at all, but in conversations with one another. I had a perfect understanding of how difficult it was for a new tester to pass the trial period, so I was baffled to see them all behaving so carelessly and wasting so much time. If I were their boss, I would install security cameras in the break rooms and fire anyone who was caught on film more than twice in one day. Maybe that was too harsh a measure, but I seriously couldn't understand what all these poor testers were hoping for. After eating the food I'd bought in the morning, I started creating my daily video report about the adventures of the flap-eared goblin herbalist. There was more than enough interesting material today, but when editing it, I hesitated for a long time deciding which parts to show my viewers. The desert oasis and orc camp, yes. The search for the Ifrit den and discovering the heart, yes. After prolonged consideration, I decided to also include my troglodyte gulping down the rare alchemy ingredient and discovering the previously unknown qualities of the Ifrit heart. Of course, by doing so, I revealed that secret to all players of Boundless Realm. But after the Legion of Steel uncovered the mystery and had combed through all markets and auctions in the game, buying up every Ifrit heart to be found, I had nothing to lose. Plus, it would be sure to increase the popularity of my video clips. I thought the strongest moment of today's video clip was my big-eared goblin receiving the unique quest Something Different, with the reward One Wish, and summoning the Legion of Steel to complete the mission. And here, I had to spend a long time deciding what to do. On the one hand, I needed to show my viewers that I had successfully completed the mission, but at the same time, I was certainly not planning to reveal precisely what wish I had made to the djinn. I also decided not to show Taisha's wish, or when she received a quest. But then it was unclear how the djinn had managed to get free, despite all the efforts of the strongest players in the game. Overall, a lot had to be cut out, and in the end, it turned out a bit too condensed. So I tried to explain the unclear moment to my viewers, telling them that the wish made to the djinn was very personal and secret, so I didn't show it. And I said the djinn was freed right after granting all wishes, which was technically true, sending many players to respawn, including Amra and Valeriana Quickfoot. After finishing the edit and uploading the video, I went to the clinic and talked with my sister. Val was clearly recovering from all her internal worries and was inspired and full of energy. She now had lots of friends, who she spent practically all day talking and playing with. That was good. I finally saw my little sister truly happy and was sincerely glad for her. The attending doctor had a positive opinion of Valeria's psychological progress after her recent suicide attempt, and he also had an optimistic outlook on the upcoming complicated procedures to implant electrodes into the girl's limb stumps. He even pointed for me at the bionic legs made specially for my sister, stored in a sterile transparent container. They were practically indistinguishable from real legs. The doctor assured me firmly that, in a few weeks, Valeria would even be able to move the toes on both legs, and in a few months, She could even walk in a special walker or with crutches, getting used to her new legs. Overall, I returned to work from the clinic in a wonderful state of mind. This morning's call of warning about killers from the grave worms no longer seemed so ghastly to me, and I even mentally reproached myself for giving in to panic and spending a whole day in a virtual reality capsule that was barely adequate for sleeping instead of a comfortable hotel room. But suddenly, in the revolving doors at the entrance to the Boundless Realm building, I passed a person who seemed dimly familiar. I strained my memory and remembered that I had met him a few times in the criminal neighborhood, either in the grocery store or next to the electro bus stop. This person, it seemed, didn't notice me and walked down the stairs away. At any rate, my fears instantly returned, but now many times stronger. The first thing I did in my work cabin was to firmly lock the door behind me and bash it hard a few times to test its strength. After that, I looked for the contact data of the corporation's security service on my computer. It was already almost 8 in the evening, time for me to load up Boundless Realm, so I wanted to avoid a long phone conversation, and especially a personal visit to security. Fortunately, I could just send this information by email. I tried to give a fairly detailed description of the problem and sent it off. Considering it a done deal, I laid down in the virtual reality capsule and began the loading procedure. The dwarven lady's son looked very much like his mother in body proportions. On the doorstep of the alchemy shop, there was a practically spherical dwarf, whose head, hands, and squat legs seemed like strange nubs protruding from an ideally spherical body. Adding to that picture was a male suit, which was clearly too short and narrow for such a body. It didn't cover his protruding stomach even to the navel. Add to that a haughtily luxurious golden helmet with lowered visor, red and green stretchy pants tucked into boots, and a set of pots, ladles, and pans hanging from a wide leather belt, and you understand what a sight was drawn before me. Tondic Exuberant, Level 43 Dwarf Chef. I walked a slow circle around the chef, who was frozen in indecision, looking with curiosity at the extremely outlandish spectacle.
"And where is your weapon, dwarf? Or were you planning to fight off the swamp beasts with your ladle, using a pan as a shield?"
The chef remained silent and just lowered his gaze, but Pyrona Zealous hurried out of the alchemy shop to defend her youngest son.
"Mr. Amra, don't you worry about weaponry. Tondik is great with knives and can hold his own in a fight."
For some reason, I had great doubt in the accuracy of these words, but I still didn't insist on a test. What was more, I had a more serious reason to worry. For some reason, I didn't see a single trader of weaponry, armor, or ammunition, even though I'd given extremely clear instructions to Pyrona Zealous on what precise objects I was planning to buy, where, and for how much. After seeing how confused I looked and how I was looking around, the owner of the alchemy shop explained,
"They aren't coming, Mr. Amra. I'm afraid I'm to blame here. I got into a big fight with my neighbors today because they didn't believe in my son at all, trying to outdo each other in mocking Tondik and saying that he'll never find a wife. And one of my neighbors is an armorer and the other is a weaponsmith. All in all, it turned out bad. However, I did pack 3 big bags of supplies for the road," said the mother, pointing at several huge piles of massive bales stacked in the corner. "There are some victuals, various items, a tent, and everything one needs for a long journey."
It wasn't good, but I didn't get particularly upset, because I saw something of a balancing of game algorithms in the NPC conflict, and that unobtrusively reminded me that this was not the real world, and that certain fixed rules did exist here. Instead of walking alone through a huge subterranean city and buying each type of item from a different person in a different place, I wanted to save time and gather all the necessary traders in one spot. But there was no such thing as a free lunch. The game algorithms of Boundless Realm had created a conflict of NPCs to make me seek out the traders I would need. I took another critical glance at the bales packed by the doting mother. I was positive Vixen wouldn't be able to take off with so much stuff, and she probably couldn't deal with Tondik's weight either. But it was no big deal. The wolves of the Grey Pack had plenty of inventory space, and I could let the fat chef ride on the strong Fimblethul. After ordering Tondik to drag the bags to the nearest exit from Dotur Kawe, I promised to come by a bit later. I still had an hour before sunset, so I set off to find the right shops. The Banks of the Styx. I noticed the orc camp when I was just a few kilometers from the Styx. Between a pitch-black swamp, strange gloomy starless sky, and anthracite black river, they had lit bright bonfires and dozens of torches, like the landing lights of a large airport. Steering my Royal Forest Wyvern right into the middle of the camp, I brought Vixen down next to the very largest central tent, justly assuming it was mine. The second I jumped off my mount, the entire gray pack appeared next to me. Akella, Lobo, Blanca, and White Fang, the level 45 hardened wolves, Darius and Arena, the level 43 wargs, and also the huge, shaggy, level 59 mythical hound Fimblethul. On the icy white hound, feverishly latched onto his thick fur, the dwarf chef was half-lying, half-sitting, his face white as chalk. His skin color even matched the fur of the unique animal.
"Climb off Fimblethul before his back breaks under your weight, and unload your bags from the other wolves," I ordered Tondik,
myself turning to the whole delegation of NPCs and living players who came out to meet me.
"Amra, how glad I am to see you!"
I was so happy to see the beefy ogre fortifier that I even allowed Shreksen to lift my goblin with his huge arms and squeeze me tight in a burst of emotion.
"Max Sochnie and I got here just a half hour ago on his galley. The Naiad trader is overseeing the unloading of goods from his tipsy albatross right now. Actually, no, there he is."
The fishman in a dashing captain's tricorn with differently colored feathers and unusual scaled armor was hurrying to greet me. I was very glad to see my friend, but there was also a high-level player behind him I was seeing for the first time. I froze, reading his information. Antonius Just, human, level 138 healer, light.
"You yourself asked me to get a map of the Styx or find people who had already been here during the previous 26 unsuccessful expeditions,"
the Naiad trader began explaining in an energized tone, pointing at his companion.
"Just imagine, I managed to find such a person, and you won't believe who he is. Timothy, this is my nephew Martin. He has been plagued for 2 years and has leveled up well in that time. Anyway, it was Martin who suggested I look into a job as a Boundless Realm tester when I was looking for work a month ago. You could even say my nephew led me to the game. Timothy, don't pay any mind to the fact that he has a marker from the clan of Wandering Healers, Life-Giving Light. Martin is a loner by nature and might leave the clan if need be."
"Yeah, I can leave whenever," the healer Antonius Just confirmed, entering our conversation. "I've been playing in this clan for 3 months, but they're real boring and passive. There has only been one mass-scale event since I joined. The leaders of the clan tried to organize an expedition up the Styx on 3 ships to the undiscovered lands, because one of our clan members got a rare or even unique quest up there. We fought our way through the Rougarou territory. We also managed to get through the lands of the giants, although they kicked our asses. I died 3 times myself. But we eventually got stuck on a sandbar and couldn't keep going by water. The river rapids were too strong. But going on the shore is just not an option. There are cyclopes there, who will instantly kill anyone they see. We tried all kinds of ways for 3 days, and each player died at least 5 times, but it was all pointless. In the end, we just gave up and never went back." The forest nymph, standing in silence not far away and surrounded by my orc cutthroats, unexpectedly lit up and asked the healer,
"So then, the unique quest remains uncompleted? You wouldn't happen to know what the mission was called, would you?"
"I once overheard the clan leader say we were 320 kilometers from the map marker, so we didn't complete it, of course. I'm not sure about the name of the quest. Something about the 12 guards of Elgar, or something like that?" Until that moment, I had been just partially listening to the conversation as I looked in thought at the mini-map, showing Max Sochnier's nephew as a black skull, meaning he was more than 50 levels higher than me. I was alarmed by some red text saying this character was on my blacklist. It was a great shame,
but Antonius Just was one of the four undying who I promised Taisha to kill for burning down the village of Tish. A very unexpected coincidence. What was the chance, after all, that a player I was searching for would come to me all on his own? It was easier to win 1,000,000 credits in the lottery than to have a chance meeting with a specific player in Boundless Realm, which was larger than the surface area of planet Earth. Perhaps this was no simple coincidence, and there was something I was missing. All the same, when he spoke of the 12 guards of Elgar, I left my considerations and jumped into the conversation, carefully asking my new acquaintance,
"Maybe it isn't the 12 guards of Elgar, but the 12 Yelivalgar guardians."
I had a ring with such a name on my finger, and also the full name of the mythical hound Fimblethul contained the phrase Yelivalgar, guardian, so I had that word in the back of my mind.
"Yes, it seems that is exactly what the quest was called,"
the human healer confirmed carelessly.
"But in any case, it was impossible to get there, so it doesn't matter. We only reached the rapids of the River Styx. But I have maps of the locations, so I can share them with you and tell you how we got past the tricky spots."
Valeriana Quickfoot looked me right in the eyes and nodded in silence. My smarty-pants sister had clearly understood everything about the still unfinished quest, which would most likely give yet another unique mythical hound. And I myself understood perfectly how intriguing it would be to finish that mission and thus reinforce the Grey Pack with such a rare creature. But getting to the place on the map the healer had so vaguely described as 320 kilometers above the rapids on the Styx, where no player had ever gone before, would be really hard, to say nothing about completing the unique mission itself, which would probably also be quite difficult. Our conversation was interrupted by a ghastly, blood-curdling wail coming from somewhere near the riverbank. The whole Grey Pack instantly shuddered and turned their snouts to the sound. Vixen even took off into the sky.
"That howl has already been going on periodically for 40 minutes, sometimes further down the river, sometimes up," my sister commented. "He's walking around us, but won't come near the camp. I don't know what it is, but your orcs have never fortified this vigorously. I ordered them to make a defensive rampart out of thorny bushes in a semicircle around the tents, and another 2 rows of sharpened stakes at an angle with the points out."
"Only pointing at the dry land? But what if something dangerous crawls out of the river?"
I asked, on guard, but Max Sochnier started laughing and hurried to reassure me.
"Amra, don't you worry about the river. My girlfriend, the Nereid Olelissa, is on guard there, and she's 7 meters of pure muscle, shark teeth, and a sharp trident and a pair of strong hands. I'll have to introduce you to my sweetheart today. I'll be honest, I didn't want to take her on the dangerous journey, but she insisted and has been swimming behind my galley the whole way. Sea creatures don't find it very comfortable in rivers, and Olelissa is complaining that the water tastes nasty. But the Nereid is the strongest and biggest thing in there, so she scares away all the river creatures with her mere presence. What's more, Olelissa has help from my pet Claymore, the 3-meter-long blazing fast swordfish, but my little fish is also feeling like hell in the fresh water."
Just then, First Mate Ziabash Hardy ran up to me, wheezing. The huge orc's hands and clothes were caked in black dirt and swamp muck. His eyes were sagging in exhaustion.
"Captain Amra, you came at just the right time. The orcs building the camp fortification are saying they can see fast shadows moving about in the distance. Lots of shadows. And also, big red eyes are gathering on the nearest hill, watching us. And there's also that howl, which rattles the bones."
I could sense that my first mate, who'd taken part in many ghastly sea battles, was now feeling close to crapping his pants in fear. I suspect that many of the other orcs were not in the best psychological condition now either, affected by the gloomy atmosphere of the swampy banks of the River of Death, the darkness of the moonless night, and the monsters gathered around the camp. I supposed now was the very time to show some leadership and invigorate my soldiers. I got up on Fimblethul to get a better view of my squadron and what was going on around me, then loudly commanded,
"Shrexen! As an experienced fortifier, I need you to get to building right away. Ziabash, tell your orcs my order. They must not stop working on the fortifications for a single second. And at that,
Break off all the soldiers into groups of 10 and send one group at a time to the galley. Our soldiers there will be given good weapons and armor.
Foreman's skill increased to level 32. Foreman's skill increased to level 33.
Here my gaze caught on Numb Spiteful, the level 50 dwarf mechanic, who crawled out of one of the tents, looked around with her eyes tearing up in the bright light of the fire, and started limping in my direction in a bouncy gait. Everyone in my army knew Numb as a reckless dwarf adventure seeker with fierce mannerisms and a complete lack of self-preservation instinct. Even the savage orcs were wary of contact with her. But I knew that the bearded lady hadn't yet fully recovered from a very severe, nearly deadly wound. But I really needed her help right now.
Numb, may your beard be burnt. Take your crutches and go help with the construction. Look after the wild cutthroats, most of whom are not able to tell a saw from a hammer. But first...
Here I noticed that the dwarf chef was still standing helplessly next to a pile of his things.
Help this walking misunderstanding. He's one of your kind, after all, I said, pointing at Tundik exuberant. He needs to pitch his tent and set up a field kitchen. After the long march today, the soldiers want to eat, so help him get to work.
Foreman's skill increased to level 34.
After giving the most necessary commands, I went off to the edge of camp in order to watch the fortification work and, at the same time, catch a glimpse of the monsters my first mate said were gathering nearby. The situation was a bit worse than I was expecting. There was obviously not enough construction material for anything resembling a serious defensive bulwark, although my orcs had already cut down all bushes and trees near the camp. The wall of stinging plants reached waist height at its highest point, and was generally even lower. The orcs were sharpening stakes and driving them into the ground, but it was obvious that they wouldn't be enough for decent defense. And the worst part was that, as for the great many monsters, Ziabash Hardy hadn't been exaggerating one bit. Hundreds of pairs of red eyes were observing our camp carefully from the nearest hill, and, with every second, the enemy was getting reinforcements, pouring in from all the nearby swamps.
Successful perception check. Experience received, 160 experience.
Swamp spirits, ghosts, banshees, skeletons of all kinds of creatures that had drowned in the local swamps. Among the enemies there were a good deal of undead from levels 80 to 100. And at that, the undead were peacefully coexisting with living creatures, also from levels 80 to 100. Plague rats, jerboas, swamp wolves, leshies, all kinds of poisonous snakes and unbelievably huge insects. Despite the variety of species, this army of all stripes had no internal conflicts and was simply standing on the hill, growing in number with each passing minute. I was extremely displeased to see the enemies had significantly higher average level than my orcs and already equaled us in number. In the case of direct wall-to-wall conflict, we already had quite low chances, and in an hour or two, the situation threatened to become utterly hopeless.
Apparently there's no avoiding a battle, the thoughtful voice of the human healer rang out behind my ear, also having come to evaluate the situation. And much to my dismay, there's no respawn stone nearby.
We didn't see a single respawn point in our whole day traversing the desert either, the Mavka added, also looking in fear at the enemy forces gathered in the distance. So, the closest place is that oasis we left a day ago. It's a pretty good slog for what it's worth. Maybe we should retreat to the galley?
But I really didn't like my sister's suggestion of retreat. If I did manage to get the 300 wild orcs on the tipsy albatross, then together with its crew of 150, we'd be packed like sardines in a can. And also, if I thought about it, we couldn't just hide on the ship forever, right? As far as I knew, the tipsy albatross was preparing to go back down the delta of the Styx into the sea right after unloading, returning to its usual cyclical trade route. In any case, the trade galley couldn't make it very far up the river. So sooner or later, we'd have to come ashore, where the situation would only be worsening with every hour. What was more, if we couldn't handle the dangers here, how could we ever hope to get higher up the Styx, where both the concentration of monsters would be higher and their level significantly more respectable? No, we needed to deal with this problem right here and now.
Battle was inevitable,
Everyone understood that perfectly. As they also understood that, with their numbers and high levels, the swamp beasts would simply wipe the floor with us if we didn't change our defensive strategy. I got up on the icy white hound to a slightly elevated area and called my orc cutthroats to attention, pointing to the pitiful attempt at a defensive bulwark.
This border is pointless. Only a